like, oh, we should have done this while everyone was doing it, because now we're getting all of these attracting people that we don't want, or are attracting more extremists just because things are, I mean, this is kindling, these are kindled times, and just the smallest spark. And I realize we're out of time. Oh, man, we should just keep going and going, but alas, there's some great cable programming coming up next. Like always, this is The Gap. We're minding it, we're bridging it, we're paying attention to it. I'm Tammy. On the line with me is Althea, and in studio is Sonia. Sonia, thank you so much for all that you do.
Oh,
Althea, thank you.
Thanks, Tammy.
And hope that you all have a great weekend. Take care. We run this dick. Girls, we run this dick. Girls, we run this dick. Girls, we run this dick.
Oh, that's so sweet. That's such a good track. Let's hear it again.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to the Got Science podcast. I'm your host, Colleen MacDonald. Today we're checking in on hurricane season, what was forecast, what we've seen so far, and what might happen if a major hurricane and COVID-19 should meet. Welcome to August, folks. It's been approximately half a year since the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in the United States, and it still doesn't look like we'll be done with this pandemic anytime soon. It's also peak hurricane season, and as we've seen in previous episodes, the pandemic has a way of making already difficult events even more difficult. So we're in for some real challenges. And that's because the way we should respond to hurricanes is at odds with the way we should act during a pandemic. For example, calling for people in harm's way to evacuate. A typical hurricane evacuation into packed shelters could easily turn into a super spreader event. And many of the communities that could get hit are already coping with COVID-related economic hardship and are unprepared for the damages a storm may bring. Dr. Astrid Caldas is a senior climate scientist here at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and she's going to walk us through what we need to look out for during this hurricane season. Because this year is unique for a number of reasons. Not only is hurricane season coinciding with a pandemic, but 2020 is also the fifth year in a row predicted to have above average activity. We recorded this interview in mid-July before many of this year's named storms even formed, and we're releasing this episode as Isaias makes its way up the eastern coast of the United States. We don't know yet what damage it will do, but we know that this will be an intense season. Our conversation brings us to what happens when a hurricane meets extreme heat, unemployment, and a pandemic. Astrid explains what climate change means for future hurricanes, both during this pandemic and after, and why the name of the game will be building resiliency. Astrid, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
How is climate change affecting these tropical storms that then turn into hurricanes?
Well, climate change is certainly making hurricane seasons worse, and that can be interpreted in many ways. In the past five hurricane seasons, we've seen that hurricanes are becoming stronger. They are becoming wetter, more wet, more rain. They are becoming slower. They tend to stall over places. And they are also becoming more destructive. And all these trends, unfortunately, have been linked to global warming. But one of the things that is important to note is that the frequency of hurricanes has not been affected by global warming. We're not having more hurricanes. Even though 2019 was the fourth year in a row that we had above average hurricane activity, there is no scientific evidence that this is caused by global warming. But a lot of studies have found that the frequency of stronger hurricanes in the Atlantic, which are category 3 or higher, category 3, 4, or 5, 5 is the highest, the frequency of the stronger hurricanes has increased. And global warming is probably a factor in that. So that's one of the important things that the science tells us. Another thing that it tells us is that they are becoming strong very fast. We hear last year in particular, we heard about hurricanes in like 24 hours going from a tropical storm, not a hurricane yet, to a category 4 or 5, super fast. And this pattern is not what you would expect by chance from natural variability alone. These higher intensification rates, as we call them, becoming very strong, very fast within 24, 48 hours, they probably have a contribution from global warming, from human burning of fossil fuels.
What's happening that is making them intensify so quickly?
Well, one of the main things that global warming causes in our climate is the intensification of rain. The rain is one of the characteristics of the hurricanes. However, there are rain events that are not linked to hurricanes, right? So, but what we're seeing lately is that there has been a lot of rain associated with a lot of hurricanes, including Hurricane Harvey was a record setting in terms of rain. The National Weather Service had even to create a new color for the amount of rain that was falling because they had never seen that much rain. And the reason for that is because of warmer air holds more water vapor. So the more water vapor in the air, the more water will fall when it turns into rain or snow. In this case, we're talking about rain because we're talking about warm weather and tropical activity. But the thing is, also with warmer weather, there is more evaporation, right? And also, there is the seas, the oceans are getting warmer because the oceans are absorbing most of the energy from global warming, from the extra greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So with a warmer ocean, the sea surface is warmer, and warm sea surfaces are actually the fuel for hurricanes. Hurricanes feed on warm water, surface water, and that's what kind of helps them form. And of course, more evaporation with the warmer water, even more rain. So that's one of the reasons that these hurricanes have been so destructive and bring so much more rain.
Astrid, you grew up in Brazil, correct?
Correct.
I'm curious how you got interested in studying climate change.
That's a very interesting question. And it's actually very straightforward for me because my path to climate change was, I was a professor for almost 25 years. And I taught insect ecology, so population and community ecology of insects. And with my field, as a field ecologist, I would go to the field to collect data with the bugs, you know, get the insects information and count them and see their interactions and things like that. And year after year, I planned my experiments. And then all of a sudden, I would had an experiment planned, but the bugs would not be there. They had come out early. Sometimes they came out early, but their food, the plant, had not come out yet. So I started seeing a disconnect between the system, between the different layers of the natural systems, the plants, the insects that eat them, the predators that eat the insects, and so forth. And it took me a few years to realize that it was climate change. And at that point, I decided that I really needed to kind of face my enemy and learn a lot about it so that I could really defeat it. Well, I couldn't defeat it, but I left academia. And I got another degree, and I completely turned from academia to climate change policy and environmental advocacy and that kind of stuff. So that's the story.
That's so interesting. So you could really see it on the ground happening before
your
eyes.
Yeah, insects are among the first groups of animals that have been shown to respond to global warming. And it's very interesting. So, but in butterflies in particular, I worked with butterflies and moths. So the butterflies were the first study on climate change was in Europe showing that some species of butterflies are moving more and more north as the weather, as the climate was getting warmer. So yeah, I could totally see it. And I had my first experience of extreme weather event when I had a huge rainstorm that blew very early in the year. And I had experiments that were little tents on the ground to kind of capture the bugs that were coming from underground. You know, they spend the winter buried and then they come out. And all those little tents were carried away by flood and water. They are somewhere in the bottom of the Chesapeake to this day. I feel bad for polluting the bay.
Wow.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid growing up, or maybe I still hear it now, but I'm thinking back, you would hear about the 100-year storm or the 500-year storm. And I'm curious about where that came from. Is that a real thing?
Well, it is a real thing in the way that it was intended to be. However, people kind of took it out of context. So the expression 100-year storm or a 500-year storm is very misleading, because the year in that expression comes from the probability that a storm is going to happen or can happen in any given year. And that probability is based in the past history of climatic events. So, you know, the very strong rainfall that's like 7 inches in 1 hour, 2 hours, whatever, that's very rare in the past. So the probability of that type of rainfall occurring in any 1 year was very low. So that led to the development of the probability of rainstorms. So the so-called 100-year storm is actually a rainstorm that has a 1% chance, or a 1 in a 100 chance, of occurring in any given year. So the same is like for the 500-year storm. It has a chance of 1 in 500 of happening in any given year. So whenever you talk of a chance of happening in 1 year, people kind of started saying that 1 in 100 years, not one chance in 100 in 1 year. So that kind of misled the whole idea, because a very low probability event is still a possible event, and doesn't mean that if it happened today, it's not going to happen again in 100 years. And particularly now with global warming and climate change, we are seeing that lots of places are seeing a lot more. For instance, we talk about 100-year rainstorms and 500-year rainstorms, and I think of Houston. Houston, just in the past 3 years, have had several 100-year events and 500-year events. So we're trying to steer away from that terminology, and we're trying to kind of stick more with the probability of 1%, 0.2%, or whatever it is, so that people do not think that they are, you know, they're safe, since they just had a big storm, and a 100-year storm, so they can remodel their whole house and then have to worry about another one.
I wonder if people who are in areas like Houston are beginning to realize that climate change is here and now, and it's happening.
They are. A lot of them are. And a lot of people are saying, I don't want to go through this anymore. They've had their homes flooded 2-3 times, many of them. And that's also a very heavy burden for the government and for the insurance companies, particularly for the federal insurance that comes through the National Federal Insurance Program, which, you know, a lot of people draw upon if they are in an area that is prone to flooding. So there are all these cases where people get flooded over and over again, and the government pays for them to fix their house and everything. But even then, people are starting to realize, I don't want to go through this again, even if I have insurance, because it's just a huge disruption. It's very dangerous. And I'd rather, you know, live where this is not happening anymore. But you see people everywhere, not only Houston, but along the Mississippi River in Midwest, for instance. Oh, this didn't used to be like that. I've never seen the river this high. I've never seen rain like this. So there is a general awareness that things are different. And that is actually very good for general public understanding of the effects of climate change and global warming.
Well, I have to say, right now, if I were living in the southeastern part of the States or the Gulf Coast, I would be very worried about hurricanes and rise in cases of COVID-19. As a scientist, what concerns you most about this potential collision?
It doesn't look good, does it?
So no.
No, it doesn't. We at UCS have been doing quite a bit of analysis with the COVID compound effects, with the natural disasters, as we call them, even though they're natural because they're not man-made directly, but they have been influenced by humans. And we see that it's a very tricky situation because evacuation, the evacuation process itself and being in a shelter can be a focus of spreading the disease of COVID if precautions are not taken to avoid social contact and many others, you know, touching surfaces and everything. So we have to think that if a major hurricane affects a large area of the country, people may not have other options. Shelter options may be limited. Social distancing may not be possible because if it's a huge hurricane, it's millions of people, where is everybody going to go, right? So a hurricane evacuation could turn into a super spreader event, and that would be terrible. So people will have to think about going to a public shelter in the event of a disaster during the pandemic, and what additional precautions that will require to ensure the health and safety of everybody. So we have been looking into emergency responses to develop safe evacuation and plans for COVID. And a lot of places, Florida in particular, has put out a document kind of explicitly talking about evacuation and sheltering during COVID. And this is something that I cannot stress enough, that all these measures have to take into account the most socially and economically vulnerable, because those are the ones that are going to be hit the hardest and are going to have the hardest time rebounding and recovering. So those have to be very, you know, you have to pay attention to those segments of the population also.
Right. So, I mean, with the lack of federal response or guidelines about the pandemic, who's in charge of coordinating a disaster response should the two collide?
Well, even though there is no federal response or guideline about the pandemic, we're seeing that the states are really taking the lead in lots of measures to protect and prevent the spread of the virus. But the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is still the agency responsible for both COVID response and the recovery from disasters in the United States. So in the hurricane emergency, FEMA is also responsible for preparing evacuations and shelters. And the intersection of the pandemic with the hurricane season is really unprecedented, but it's going to happen right now, and FEMA has its resources used to the max because of the pandemic already. So I worry about being prepared for both hurricanes and COVID. It's a very difficult task. And hurricanes come during the hottest times of the year. So add extreme heat to that equation, and you have people who are going to have to escape not only the hurricane, but people who may already been trying to escape the heat, people who will be struggling, particularly people who are low income, people who don't have air conditioning, they can't afford to turn it on. So there is an additional layer of sheltering and protection that is required and that FEMA is going to have to deal with. Man, I'm telling you, I wouldn't want to be in FEMA's shoes right now. And another detail that I'd like to say, Colleen, Black and Latino segments of the population have been shown in studies and statistics that to be more affected by COVID. They have also lost their jobs at a higher rate than white people. So if you put heat, hurricanes, unemployment, and it's like a triple whammy, and you put COVID to top on that, it's a quadruple whammy. So it's really a bad scenario that we're talking about, unfortunately.
We'll be back in a minute with the second half of our interview. The Got Science podcast is brought to you by the Union of Concerned Scientists. More at gotsciencepodcast.org. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, PRX, SoundCloud, and all the usual podcast outlets. For a transcript and links to additional resources from this episode and a full bio of our guest, head over to gotsciencepodcast.org. If you like the podcast, you can help us out by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts and share us with your friends, family, coworkers, and on your social networks. And finally, if you're on Twitter, come talk to us at GotScienceUCS. Now let's get back to our interview. Well, I've talked in previous podcast episodes about the disproportionate effect of COVID on African American, Latinx people, people who are socially and economically vulnerable. What can we do to protect these communities?
Yeah, we are seeing that this year is really unprecedented, not only with the things that are happening in the public health climate. We are in the middle of a big heat wave right now here in the South and up to the mid-Atlantic, and social with all the protests and everything about racism and Black Lives Matter. So it's a convergence of situations that are really making this year very unique. And but our solutions for an effective response must address all the situations that increase the risks, I think, and focus on the health and well-being of people, particularly those that have historically been marginalized and discriminated against. So we really need policies that provide those underserved communities with the means to really better cope with disasters. So we need to build resilience, as we say it in the adaptation and climate practice. Building resilience means giving people the ability to better resist impact, not just recover from it. It's a way of kind of I'm gonna hold on better than I did in the past. And we need policies that will improve living conditions, provide equitable disaster relief, because unfortunately, studies, more than one, have shown that disaster relief discriminates against certain segments of the population, perpetuating inequity and increasing the gap between wealth and poor. So we need the policies at all levels, federal, state, local, and think ahead so that we can be prepared when there are there is a confluence of problems, you know, there is a collision of health, social, economic crisis. So, yeah, we need to be ready.
So, Astrid, if I gave you a direct line to Congress or could set you up, you know, with a private meeting, what are the solutions that you would advocate for sort of most strongly, like your top five, we need to do these things immediately?
Oh, boy.
I've given you the power.
I've got the power. I would say I start with safe and stable public housing, or housing that is affordable to all segments of the population. And by safe, I mean not only the structure, but the location, right? So that the people who are low income and who are minorities are not in the places they are going to be hit worse by the natural disasters. In terms of the heat waves that are increasing and that compound the risks, not only of the pandemic, but of hurricanes and everything else, I would say that we have some mandates for heating. We have a basic kind of standard for heating in housing. So we need to have air conditioning also to cool people during the hotter months. Of course, universal health care, I think that's a very important thing, because we are seeing right now that with COVID, a lot of minorities, Black and Latinos, are being hit the worst, because not only do they have to go out to work, because a lot of them work in what is considered essential segments of the economy, but they also do not have regular medical care, so that puts them more at risk. And safe housing, again, they live in areas that have a lot of pollution, environmental problems, so all this compounds everything. So protections for workers that are paid by the hour. A lot of these people, if a disaster hits, they don't get money, they don't get paid, so they get their situation even worse, because then they cannot evacuate, they cannot protect themselves, they cannot get food, and it's horrible. So all this brings me to anti-racist practices and you know, some sort of regulations, legislations that really look into the most vulnerable and that really stop perpetuating inequities and racism in our country, which is a huge, huge problem.
You know, it's interesting, Astrid. I was thinking, since we've all been working from home, and I'm up here in the Northeast in the Boston area, and it's summertime now, and we're just about to head into a heat wave, and I don't have air conditioning at my house. I have one small room where I have a little window air conditioner because mostly I'm going into the office and on hot days it's air conditioned. But it's really made me think people that don't have air conditioning, they're living in Florida. They're living in places where you can't survive without air conditioning. And with COVID, you suddenly have, I mean, maybe people can go to a cooling center, but if you can't be in a space with other people because now you're at risk of getting COVID, it's really challenging for people who don't have resources.
Yeah.
I mean, it just really brings it
it
home.
Does. You're putting these people in a impossible situation, right? To have to make a decision because both decisions are health decisions. Because we know that extreme heat can have a lot of implications on the human body. The thing is, a lot of people who have pre-existing conditions also, they cannot afford to be in the heat. So you put all those things together and really to make decisions of what's the worst evil, it's not something that we'll want to put anybody in. It's not a situation that anybody should be in. And we are seeing that with the extreme heat, which is increasing a lot. We did at UCS a study called Killer Heat that projected extreme heat days into the future. And the spread of extreme heat days in areas that are not used to seeing even 90 degree days regularly, it's just unbelievable. And a lot of those places, like you said, don't have air conditioning because they never needed it. So now there's going to be the need for air conditioning and there's going to be the demand in our energy supply and power grid. So these things are cascading effects that we can't even imagine, you know, all the extension of everything.
So let's talk for a minute just about climate solutions, because we need to adapt, but we also need to solve the root problem. What solutions would you put forward?
Well, the main thing that we need is to kind of stop global warming on its tracks, right? We know that we are not at an irreversible point. 2 years ago, at the end of 2018, there were studies that were released both by the U.S. government, the National Climate Assessment, and by Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change, international body of thousands of scientists. And they both got to have the same conclusion. We have warmed 1.8 Fahrenheit, 1 degree centigrade, 1 Celsius. And at this point, we're already seeing a lot of problems like the hurricane intensification, like the extreme rain events, and the biodiversity loss, and the coral reefs, and the warming of the ocean. But we are not at a point where we cannot reverse it. If we slow down the emissions from the burning of fossil fuels, right now we start the process, we can get to a point where the worst of all these very bad impacts of global warming will be avoided. So what we say and what the IPCC, which is the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change, recommends and talks is a complete change, a deep change in our thinking and in our lifestyles that might lead to a perfect situation where we can really slow down global warming. UCS did a study back in 2012 or 13 that said that if everybody in the United States at that time reduced their carbon footprint by 20%, it would be the equivalent of closing one-third of the U.S. coal-fired plants. So that's a huge amount of emissions. So why not do something? Why not think about changing something now when I can, as opposed to in the future having to change things because there is no other way, right?
Right, sort of an all hands on deck, individuals to states,
yes,
to governments,
absolutely,
to countries.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Astrid, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. This has been fun. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Got Science podcast. Got Science is made possible by the 130,000 members of UCS, and especially our partners for the Earth, the 12,000 supporters who make monthly contributions to stand up for science. More at ucsusa.org/partners. Special thanks to Dr. Astrid Caldas. Editing by Omari Spears. Additional editing and music by Brian Middleton. Research and writing by Pamela Worth and Jiayu Liang. Our executive producer is Rich Hayes, and I'm your host, Colleen MacDonald. Stay safe and see you next time.
You're listening to Community Radio,
KBOO, Portland.
The following program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant.
Good morning, this is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder,
board operator.
Today I am interviewing Andrew Epperson. He has had problems with a wheelchair company and we will be discussing it today. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, John.
So, Andrew, can you explain to me the problems you were having with your wheelchair?
Yeah, John. So it's an issue where several parts have went out, the motors, actuator, show out the chair. 2.5 years, it's probably spent the bulk of a year and some months in the shop.
And how much difficulty has with your wheelchair, in the shop, that must have reduced your mobility, your socialization, and your independence by, at least a little bit.
Quite a lot, actually, because I only use my power chair, so I'm essentially homebound.
That must interfere with your overall, does that interfere with your health and stuff like that as well? When you're homebound, does that kind of what I'm trying to get at is does it interfere with your ability to get out there and get some exercise, some sunlight, to go grocery shopping and all the things you kind of need to do to keep on living from day to day?
Yeah, absolutely it does. Currently, of course, we're all dealing with the pandemic that's going on. While it is different because of my fault, it's much the same symptom for me where, I'm not leaving the house, I can't grocery shopping, I can't easily get to a doctor. Luckily, I have doctors that come in home, largely because of situations like this, and they're like, well, you're homebound more than you're not, so we are going to go ahead and qualify for the program. And I have providers that they're, they're home with me trying to keep the spirits up as best they can. In home, I'm not great for anyone's mental health to have no exposure to socialize or get sunlight or put your head out for fun. All that stuff stops when it cares. So I would say, physically and mentally, it should be addressed in a much better fashion so that doesn't happen.
And when you say addressed in a much better fashion,
the time that it takes a company that is replacing the parts to get the parts approved by the insurance and process the own paperwork.
And I take it.
My last parts took
4 months? That seems ludicrously, ridiculously long.
My last set of motors were like 5 months, because someone went on vacation at the insurance company and they're like, oh, sorry, the person's handled that gone, so they didn't get pushed through. We got it now. The wheelchair companies can only hold the parts for so long, then they can set it back, and the whole thing.
You've been just dealing with one wheelchair company, or what's... And
other than out of pocket rental, which is a whole other thing to talk about, because I have a specialized chair.
Yeah.
If the chair isn't almost exactly the same type of chair that I have, legally, they can't give me anything to rent on insurance. So last time I tried to rent one cash, but my chair is so me specific that the chair that I rented, which ended up costing like $400 for a month, didn't even work. So they took it back after a week and charged me a week, which was like $100.
And you had to pay for this all out of your pocket.
Yeah, because they won't, the insurance won't cover a chair that doesn't come from one of their contract companies. So there was two companies that could come from, New Motion and another company. And if they don't have a class 3 wheelchair, which is a really specialized wheelchair where I had stiff tails and everything else that I need, then they just don't have it if you don't get it.
Being that you need a specialized wheelchair, I am kind of curious, does it cause health problems when you have to rent a wheelchair that's not customized to you?
Oh, yeah. Because I have been a state. It's just basically issues with veins in my legs. So I get edema, which is just another word for swelling in my leg, fluid. So if I can't tilt and my legs hang all day, that's a problem.
Andrew, what were some of the worst issues that you had with this company?
I guess the biggest one to stick out would be lack of communication. They weren't good about telling me where we were in the process of getting the part. They weren't good about taking accountability for what paperwork they should have had done, letting me know, when it was on their side.
And have you heard of anybody else who's had problems with this company?
Oh my. Yeah. Just on my Facebook friends list alone, I can think of 3 to 4 people.
3 to 4 people?
Yeah. In fact, a friend, she got 2 different sets of motors, 1 different motor on Friday, and it took multiple months for them to bring me back.
Wow. Just out of curiosity, it shouldn't normally take that long to have a wheelchair motor repaired. What would you say? I mean, obviously a couple of months is pretty long to have for anybody to take to repair something. What would you say would be reasonable?
What you and I believe is reasonable is not what typical? I guess typical would be somewhere between a month to 3 months, because it all depends on how long the wheelchair company takes profit. They assign a thing, and the insurance companies are to process their side of things, and that's what makes things kind of string along, where they take longer. But the process for payments is way too long, and they don't, by they, I mean the grocery company and the insurance company, don't account for the damage that's being done while they're taking.
It sounds like the bureaucracy is kind of doing a lot of damage, or...
Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, the insurance company, so they'll take time to decide if they want to process an order, like promoters, whatever part of it. And as they're doing that, there's other issues being caused by not having a chair, and they had to start sending out home health nurses because I can't really be gone without a chair, and the issues still needed to be dealt with and looked at. So while they're complaining about the money they're spending to remedy the cost of the chair and not wanting to speed things up, they're spending upwards of probably, I think the last statement I saw was around $1,300 a month for, I mean, granted, some of that was care supplies, but they're spending a significant amount of money to have that nurse come out when they should pay a little bit more money and probably express the part.
Well, isn't it always with the system that they take the longest, most complicated, and more expensive route rather than doing things the right way?
In general, yeah, that's been my experience, especially with durable medical equipment. It's just the entire process broken from, you know, whether it's from the dealer or the manufacturer of the chair or the insurance company, the way they process it, it's just completely broken.
Yeah, tell me about it. The whole system when it comes to disabilities is broken in half.
Great.
Obviously, during this downtime, when your wheelchair is not functioning, you still have to deal with life and life problems and stuff like that. And how do you manage to get that stuff done without your wheelchair, I guess was what I'm asking. Yes.
I'm entirely dependent, basically, because I can't go anywhere unless I, if it's a medical appointment, I could be in medical transit and be, if I had to be, I could be journeying to a doctor's appointment. As far as anything else, I'm either doing it electronically, you know, anything I can pay online, I'm paying online, or I have support providers doing different tasks for me. But yeah, I mean, I'm stuck at home. There's nothing else I can do about it but try to speed the process along.
How complicated is this pandemic making other things?
It's made things more complicated. My provider, when available, gets some things picked up for me, like the prescriptions and stuff, but it also requires a lot of grocery delivery because it's really the only option to replace things that are missing.
Hey, Andrew, I understand you're a self-advocate. Do you mind telling me what you're passionate about advocating for?
John, you have issues. You know, one of the bigger things I've been trying to advocate for is obviously better management of durable medical equipment, wheelchairs, hospital beds, things like that, better coverage, better turnaround times, that sort of thing. And secondarily, also, wheelchair accessible transportation, because while yes, a bus is available, it doesn't work for everyone. Yes, providers are available, but 95% of them don't have a vehicle that can load a motorized wheelchair. That's difficult. The Lyft TriMet system is a lot of times a long way to reach and pick up, and can be distressing for certain conditions. And taxis are a long way and expensive. So it's general accessible transportation is just, it's expensive and time consuming. So those are my two big, I guess you could call them passion projects, but also they're my necessities, and I know there's limitations of many other people in the disability community.
Yeah, I really want to thank you for, you know, getting in and advocating in the in those areas. We need all the self-advocates we can get and all the voices we can get to constantly tell the legislation, both federal, state, all the governments, county, city, all that, about, hey, what we need to make us productive and you know, what we need to make us really good citizens and stuff like that.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it might seem like the silent minority for a while, but, you know, over time, it seems like any cause gets a vocal minority, and they have to hear you eventually. So we'll certainly get where we need to be with things now.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for getting in there and lending your voice to ours. I'd also really, really like to, you know, if you got the time and you want to do it and it seems worthwhile to you, we do have self-advocates taking action every second Friday of the month from 11 to 1. And we can do Zoom. So, I mean... you know, feel free to join us.
Yeah, I'd love to.
People with disabilities often get the shaft end of things.
A lot of isolation.
Yeah, see, I've experienced an awful lot of that myself. I mean, everybody looks at me and says, you seem pretty sociable, but trust me, there's... When you're a person with a disability, you spend a large portion of your time in your own thoughts and in your own brain and alone.
And sometimes that's not the best place to be.
No, it really isn't. It really isn't. I want to thank you for sharing that with me, by the way.
Happy to.
So, Andrew, is there anything you'd like to share?
Yeah, so going back to our earlier touch on the pandemic, I did want to share something that I thought was wildly mismanaged and incorrect for several people in the disability community, and also, frankly, the elderly. So you're familiar with the $1,200 stimulus checks, I assume?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so if someone is living with their parent, whether they're elderly or disabled, or really anyone, living with anyone, and they happen to be claimed on their tax as a dependent, a lot of tax places will advise you to claim them as an adult dependent, because it sometimes gives tax breaks of some kind. And when you do that, it's generally not a problem if you don't get it. But in the case of the pandemic, because I was claimed as a dependent, the IRS/federal government decided that I don't need a stimulus check because I'm financially dependent. But where that becomes an issue for me is this. Under the rules of SFI, no one is supposed to give me any assistance with, you know, income, cash, gift cards, rental assistance, food assistance, and, you know, pretty much anything. So I'm not really sure how they can say, oh, well, you're someone's tax dependent, so you don't need this money, but also they better not give you any money. And it's not as if they gave them a $500 child credit. They just zeroed out my ability to get any funds whatsoever.
Wait a minute. Let me see if I get this correct. You don't get enough money to survive as is, but yet when it came down to the stimulus check, if you'd gotten it, you would have gotten penalized for it?
No. So because I'm claimed by someone in my home as a tax dependent, they zeroed out my stimulus check debt. So I didn't get it. And if I was underage, my parent would have gotten the $500. But because I'm an adult, they didn't give them anything and they didn't give me anything. They just zeroed it out. And that also happens if you're elderly and living in a loved one's home because you need care and they claim you're dependent, then you also can get money.
Holy crap. You got this whole stimulus, you got nothing either way.
Right.
That seems wrong.
Yeah, it definitely felt wrong, especially with having extra costs related to the pandemic. But they think because we're receiving the sum that they give us monthly, they don't check on.
Yeah, but I mean, even the monthly amount of money that they give you is still pretty small. You know, I know because I get a monthly sum of money, and it trust me, it doesn't stretch. It really just doesn't stretch.
No, it definitely does not adjust for the cost of.
And it sounds to me like they didn't give you the $1,200 or even a $500 thing. And even if they had, that still is too small to really kind of... I mean, it would have helped, but it's still pretty small considering, how much you've got to stretch it out for.
Correct. So, I mean, it would, like you said, it would have helped. I don't know how much it would have helped, but it was better than just being zeroed out because I'm playing the tax return. That doesn't change the rules around someone giving me money or any kind of support, so I don't know why it changes my ability to receive it just because I'm a tax return. That was clearly, to me, it was just personal opinion, not fact. But to me, I felt like disabled and elderly people were made as the bargaining chip to pass for legislation. That's the way it comes across to me.
Yeah, and that seems, considering they gave out $1.4 billion to people who are already dead, I'm just like, you could have taken that $1.4 billion and turned around and given it to people who have a disability and helped them out a whole lot.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of places money can go to help. Luckily, they did give me stimulus checks to houseless people and people in long-term care homes, or at least someone of experience, because I have a friend who's in a long-term care home, and they did receive stimulus checks. So I was glad to see that, but it's like, I'll be
Yeah, and it also kind of, I mean, it's sort of like the government slapping you in the face and saying, we don't care about you.
Yeah, that's definitely how it felt. I was definitely beyond frustrated. You know, I went through that for a while, but then, you move forward and you start advocating.
Yeah, and like I said, we really look forward to having your voice at the table. And we really hope to see you, at Self Advocates Taking Action. And who knows, maybe we can set up Zoom meetings and get you down in Salem.
Yeah, that sounds like a good thing to get together on. And I think we'll definitely make some awesome progress.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Andrew, for letting us interview you and taking the time out of your busy schedule to tell us about the difficulties you're having in your life.
Absolutely, John. I was happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kbu.org.
Also, we're always looking for fun, inexpensive things to do out in the community. Go to disabilityjustice@kboo.org to contact us and give us your ideas.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Next on Black Book Talk, you'll hear host O.B. Hill's 2013 interview with Benny Fields, the son of Wilmer Fields, author of My Life in the Negro Leagues, an